Okay. A couple of quick announcements so that you'll be aware of what the schedule is for the summer. I'm going to put Samson to bed this morning, and Rocky's going to put him to rest next week. And that, in essence, ends the chronology of the book of Judges. And some, all of you are saying, but wait a minute, that's not the end of the book. There are five more chapters there. The events that occur in chapter 17 to 21 are really occurred sometime during the period of the Judges. When they occurred, we really don't know. When Rocky and I first sat down to do the study of Judges, we said, we're just not even going to do those chapters. We've changed our mind, and I will do those chapters in more of a pastoral perspective of overviewing. So I'm going to give you chapter 17 and 18 on one Sunday, and then chapters 20 and 21 on another Sunday.
Yes, sir. Let's be honest, you already have the work done.
I do have a lot of work done. I did these as five chapters I did as topical studies a number of years ago. And so I have some framework to work from, and that makes it a little bit easier, and that's why we're going to do that. And that'll take us through the middle of July. Then we're going to pick up the book of Ruth, because Ruth occurred during the period of the Judges. As a matter of fact, if you read the first verse of the book, that's what it tells you, so you know that. And we'll take 4 weeks through the book of Ruth, which will take us through the end of August. Then we're going to take a couple of weeks off, probably three. You know, the last couple of weeks of August, first week of September. We'll have some substitutes. And then we're going to pick up a new series. And if you'd like to have input into what that might be, this is your opportunity. Jot a note, send us an email. Rocky and I will be meeting a few times over the summer just to discuss. We have our own ideas, but you might have some ideas too, and we're certainly willing to put those into the pot and stir it up and see how God leads and provides for that in that direction. So again, beginning in September, we will pick up another series, and if you have some input in that, that'd be great. Does that about cover what I was supposed to do?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Last night, as we finished the concert and I was out in the commons chatting with people, Dr. Johnson comes up to me and he goes, "Well, have you put Samson to bed for the night?" And I think what he meant was, you know, have you finished your study in preparation? But what I heard was, yeah, I'm putting Samson to bed, and that's where we often find him, in the wrong bed. So with that in mind, turn to Judges chapter 16. Oscar Wilde, or at least it's attributed to him, once said, "I can resist anything except temptation." And that seems to be an accurate analysis of Samson. Because when we get to chapter 16 and we get into the details of this story, you realize this is not a church story. Matter of fact, if you really get into the details, it's not even a story that you'd like to tell in mixed company. It might be a good bar story for a group of men sitting around having a beer, or two, or three, or four. Because Samson entangles himself with a local prostitute, and then he entangles himself with a Philistine woman, which ultimately leads to his demise. I don't intend to be offensive in the midst of this story, but I think I need to be accurate to the truth of Scripture. But let's start with the good news first. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 34, read this. "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me, says the author, if I tell of Gideon, of Barak, or Samson, or Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight." That's a description of Samson. That's not the record that you read in Judges, though, is it? I mean, where in the world did Samson exercise faith and trust in God? Rocky will tell us next week. No. What I discover, and I think you would agree, it's obvious that when you see these characters, these individuals, it's more about God's amazing grace than it is about the folks that are being used. Which ought to be an encouragement to us as well, by the way, because it is about what God does in our lives and how incredibly gracious and kind and empowering He is to use us even in our weakened state. Because Samson finds himself often entrapped by what we'll call the lust of the eyes. Chapter 16, verse 1. Samson went to Gaza, and he saw a harlot there, and he went into her. And it was told to the Gazite, saying, "Samson has come here." They surrounded the place. They lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And they kept silent all night, saying, "Let us wait until the morning light, then we'll kill him." Now Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the city gate and the two posts and pulled them up along with the bars, and he put them on his shoulders and he carried them up to the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron. At some time during Samson's 20 years of service as a judge, he chooses to go to Gaza. Because the story is told in chapter 16, we're assuming it's nearer the end of that 20-year period than it is at the beginning of that period. No specific reason is given. He just chooses to go there. Gaza lay on the Mediterranean coast. It's the heart of Philistine territory. It was located on the main trade route from Egypt up through the Mediterranean. Many travelers would pass through the city. It was one of five major cities of the Philistine dynasty. One writer said if there were post offices in Philistines, Samson's picture would have been on it. Wanted. So why in the world would Samson venture there? I think Samson thought he was pretty much invincible. He can go anywhere he wants. And on his trip to Gaza, he sees a harlot. In our words, what we would call a prostitute. The word saw that's used here is the same word that's used in chapter 14 when he saw the woman of Timnah. He sees and he wants. It may be almost 15, 20 years in between those two events, but Samson's still the same person. What he sees is what he wants. He's attracted by the lust of the eyes. Let me put it this way. Just because something looks good or someone looks good, it doesn't mean it's good for you. Remember Eve in the garden? She saw. Same word. The problem wasn't with the seeing. The problem was what they did with what they saw. I mean, and what she saw is what God had created, and what God had created was good. So it wouldn't be any surprise that what she saw is what she saw. But just because it was good, and just because it was created by God, didn't mean she was supposed to eat it, because God had put boundaries on that particular fruit. In much the same way for Samson, God had put boundaries, and as he does the same for us, in terms of immorality. Yet Samson ignored those boundaries. He went in, boel, it's a Hebrew word, meaning to go to, and it's often used as a euphemism for sexual relationships. Samson went into her. When we stop and actually pause and think about this, it does seem somewhat incredible to us that a man who's a servant of God, who's been chosen by God to be his representative for that culture in that time, and did such great things in the power of the Spirit, would choose to visit that kind of place and spend time with that kind of individual. We could say you can see the moral deterioration of Samson, because at least in chapter 14, when he saw the woman in Timnah, he wanted to marry her. Now when he sees the woman, he has no interest in marriage. He just has interest in the benefits that he can get out of that. And upon his arrival, someone recognizes him. That's no surprise. He was a menace to the Philistines. They'd been unable to stop him in any capacity, no matter how hard they tried, whether they sent a few men or 1,000 men or solved a riddle. And he gets reported to the authorities, and they come up with a plan. Here's the plan. We're going to capture Samson. We're going to surround the city gate, because that's the only way to get out of the city. And when Samson gets up in the morning, we'll jump upon him and capture him. Now, why in the world they thought that would be an effective plan? When they knew that Samson had already killed over 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey. Why in the world did they think they were capable of capturing Samson? They were probably men in their 20s, and they thought they were invincible too. I don't know, but maybe they were too young to remember, or they forgot about the stories. Samson, however, only stays till midnight. He doesn't stay all night. He arrives at the city gate. He finds that it's locked and secure. Now, again, a description of the city gates would help. A big picture would be beneficial to us. We've all seen pictures of castles with gates, and that kind of gives you a picture, an idea. These were often in the Philistine territory, nails studded and metal plated because they didn't want them burned by the enemies who had attacked the cities. They were attached with iron posts. They were large, heavy, larger than two men together, stretched out, taller, 8 to 10 feet in height, made of hard wood and coated with metal. So what's Samson going to do? The gates are locked. Now, by the way, the text tells us that the men of the city had surrounded the city gates, and because it was midnight, my suspicion is they'd fallen asleep. nothing had happened. Nothing was going to happen until morning, but we'll be here. So Samson gets to the city gate, and what's he going to do? Climb over? You know, punch a hole through? Yes, sir.
The gates would normally be locked to keep people from the outside from coming in.
Correct.
I'm assuming this is a little bit before the kind of locks we think of with a key. How
yep.
would they have locked them from the inside to keep somebody inside from getting out?
So he could have just slipped the bolt and walked out the door, right? You're right. He could have.
Okay.
Yes. But that's not what he does he? He literally picks up the gates, brings them out of the ground, and carries them away. And you think, why in the world is this story in Scripture, and what does this do? What's the big deal? Well, what's the symbolism of the city gates? What's the purpose of the city gate? As has already been said, to keep people out, keep the enemy out. It's a place of protection. It's a place in which the authorities of the city conducted business. It was the civil headquarters, if you will. So to possess the city gates, if you're in possession of the gates, it means you've defeated the city. It means you have authority over the city, and you're in control. Simply by taking the gates. And so Samson takes these gates, and the text says, march them off opposite of Hebron. And here's an interesting concept here, because no one's really sure exactly what that means, because Hebron was about 40 miles away. So did Samson literally walk these huge, heavy city gates 40 miles? Well, he could have. But my suspicion is that he went to a large hill heading towards Hebron that overlooked Gaza, because the purpose was to demonstrate that he had victory over Gaza. Matter of fact, if you took Kyle and Delitzsch's commentary on the Old Testament, their statement in reference to this says, to the east of Gaza, there's a range of hills. They run from north to south, and the highest of them is one which stands somewhat isolated, about a half hour's walk southeast of the town, and it's called El Montar. And from that hill, there's a splendid view of the whole valley. And according to ancient tradition, that's the summit of the hill that Samson carried the gate, which makes sense. But it's the end of the story. It ends right there. Samson's gone to Gaza. He had an evening with a woman of the ill repute, rips the city gates out, goes up on the hill, says, see, I'm invincible, and goes away. And it is about this time, so it's soon after this event, as you get to verse 4, that we encounter the story of Samson and Delilah. And if verses 1 through 3 represent Samson sowing wild oats, then verses 4 through 21 picture him reaping the results of his oats that he sowed. The story of Samson's downfall at the hands of Delilah is probably one of the most famous stories of Scripture. It's certainly been made into numerous movies. It's a blend of treachery and deceit and violence and love and betrayal and sex. Gives it all the dimensions of a Hollywood production. I was tempted to actually show excerpts, but I thought, nah, not a good idea. So, it's been told and retold throughout the ages. But again, when we stop and think and look at the story, we really know very little about Delilah. It's not specifically stated that she's a Philistine. Her name is somewhat Semitic, so she could have been the daughter of a mixed marriage. That wouldn't really have been a surprise. She could have been a Philistine. We really don't know. What we do know is that Samson, in his indomitable way, continually was attracted to her beauty, and that she was more into the relationship because of what she could get out of it as well, but for her it was the money, as we'll soon discover. The text tells us, and it's for the first time, as far as we know, in Samson's life, he actually, quote, falls in love. All the other women that Samson saw, he wanted. Now, the text tells us he's in love. It's the Hebrew word ahav. It's used of human love for one another. It's used of love for God as a human loving God. It's used of a human loving God's ways, the truth of God, the laws of God. It's used of God loving mankind. I mean, we, if we have any kind of concept, we use love in so many different ways as English-speaking people. As Bible people, we recognize that Greek has different words for love, which gives us areas of whether it's sexual love or friendship love or self-sacrificial love. But Hebrew is much like English in that sense. It's got one big word for love. So for Samson to love Delilah would include the physical aspect, but it would also include he does care about her. The caring aspect of love that you would express if you said, I really love this person, as opposed to I just like this other guy. You know. Samson's history, however, would tell us that his emphasis is probably more on the physical than the caring aspect. Nothing is mentioned here, by the way, about marriage, is it? So we're assuming, again, Samson is simply living with Delilah. Now, she lived in the Valley of Sorek, which is somewhere between Samson's hometown of Zorah and the town of Timnah. You remember Timnah, where Samson found the first woman that he was going to marry? So Samson spent a lot of time walking through the valley. This was a common path of travel for Samson. On this particular time, or on a number of his journeys, maybe he saw her, but at least now he has run into a woman by the name of Delilah. And isn't it interesting, by the way, that the other two women we have no names for? You know, the woman from Timnah and the prostitute are no name. They're just women, unnamed women. Here we have Delilah. Now, how long the relationship existed between Delilah and Samson before she was approached by the Philistines, again, it's not mentioned. My assumption is that there had a period of time had elapsed from the time Samson started his relationship with Delilah before the Philistines came and approached Delilah about a proposition. Because I think they were waiting for an opportunity to see Samson, and they were trying to figure out where he was and what he was doing. And he seems to have settled in. The Philistines had five major city-states. Gaza, as we've already mentioned, is one of those. Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. and who came from Gath later on, the Philistine giant. Each one of those cities had a ruler, or what we might call a mayor, who was in charge of the city-state. These five rulers approach Delilah. Because all five of them come to Delilah, we can assume that there was some council of the Philistines who had met a number of times figuring, we've got to figure a way to get rid of Samson. Anybody have any ideas? Because they'd exhausted their ideas. He defeated so many of the army and the soldiers that that wasn't seem to be effective. He had been able to weasel his way out of situations with riddles and rhymes. And so they're trying to figure out how they're going to capture Samson. What's the secret to his strength? And so they come to Delilah and they offer to her a huge sum of money. Verse 5, the lords of the Philistines came to her and said, entice him. See where his great strength lies and how we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. Then we'll give you 1,100 pieces each. We will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. Now note two things. One, their goal was not to kill Samson. The goal was to capture him and humiliate him. That's what the word means, to afflict, to humiliate. And they, secondly, they offer to her, each one of them, 1,100 pieces of silver. Now look in chapter 17, just skip ahead to verse 10, because I want you to see a monetary value here. Micah said to him, dwell with me, be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, and a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. That is, I'll take care of you. So that 10 pieces of silver a year was a standard yearly wage to care for somebody that was working for you. Well, if that's true, and Delilah is being offered 500 times that, Delilah is about to win the lottery. If she can get Samson to do one thing, just one thing, figure out where his strength comes from. Delilah is not a riddle person. Delilah doesn't mince words. Do you know what she says? Look at what she says. Samson, would you please tell me where you get your great strength is and how we may bound you to afflict you? Just tell us so we can humiliate you. Here's the goal. I'm telling you exactly what I want, so there's no miscommunication here. You know what I'm looking for. Samson goes, okay. Sure, this sounds like a fun game. And this is exactly what I think it was to Samson. It's horseplay. It's a game. It's an opportunity for him to demonstrate his prowess, not only mentally, but physically. So Samson says, if you bind me, verse 7, with 7 fresh cords that have not been dried, I will become weak and be like any other man. So the lords of the Philistines brought to her 7 fresh cords that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. And then she had the men lying in wait in an inner room, and she said to him, Samson, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. He snapped the cord as a string of tow snaps when it touches the fire, so his strength was not discovered. Delilah feels as if she's been deceived. Really? Of course she has. The word literally means made fun of. Because she has. She came with a request. Samson said, okay, I got an idea. Let's play a game. Determined to get the money, she tries again. Behold, she says, verse 10, Samson, you deceived me. You told me lies. Please tell me how you may be bound. Samson goes, okay. If they bind me tightly with new ropes, which have not been used, I'll become weak and be like other men. So Delilah took the new ropes, bound him with them, and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. for the men were lying in wait in the inner room, but he snapped the ropes from his arms like a thread. Now, I think there are a couple things we need to recognize, that when Delilah cried out, "The Philistines are upon you," they were not standing in the room. They were hiding in a different room. And when Samson got up and snapped the rope, they did not show up. Okay. They're hiding to see if this thing is really going to work. And I think the second thing we need to recognize is this: these events probably did not happen on three consecutive evenings. I think there was one event, and then there was a time period before the next one, a few days, maybe a week or more before the next event. So a time frame is going by, and you realize that more when you get to the fourth time, when she had to call for the Philistines and wait for them to bring what she needed in order to bind Samson. The second attempt fails. Delilah gives it another shot in verse 13. She said, "Up to now, you've deceived me. You've told me lies. Tell me how you may be bound." Notice Delilah never changes her story. She wants to know what's going to make Samson weak. What's the secret of his strength? And he said to her, "If you weave the seven locks of my hair with the web and fasten it with the pin, then I will come be weak like any other man." Now, I am not a seamstress or a weaver of cloth or a rug maker by any means. And trying to figure out exactly what happened here, and if you want to read commentaries, you can have some fun, because they don't know either, in terms of the activities and what this actually looked like. If it was a typical, from what I could gather, loom of that period, it had two vertical posts that would be fixed in the floor. Okay, across the top would be like a cross beam. And that's where the warp thread, you know, the warp and the woof, you've heard that phrase, right, which is a threading term. The warp threads would be hung. And there was to be a pin that kind of wound them together to make the rug or the cloth. So somehow the long hair of Samson was woven into a warp, beaten up with the web with this pin, and it produced a firm piece of material. Now, either Samson was a really, really sound sleeper, or he knew exactly what was going on. I'd like to suggest to you he knew exactly. He closed his eyes and said, "Go ahead, have fun." This would be really interesting to watch this. What's the irony, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, is the phrase that's translated here, "fastened with the pin," can be translated "driven with the pin," and that's exactly the phrase that's used when Jael took the tent peg and drove it through the skull of Sisera. Same words. She took the pin and drove it through his hair and tightened it. And Delilah cries out again, "The Philistines are here." And for the third time, Samson frees himself with minimal effort. It's just a game. It's a riddle. It's horseplay. No harm, no foul. Delilah's had enough, because now she plays in verse 15 the trump card. "How can you say you love me and not tell me the truth?" No. She hadn't said anything about love previous to this in the other three attempts. She just said, "Samson, just tell me the secret of your strength. Samson, you've deceived me. You've lied to me. How do I really know you love me? Maybe you're lying about loving me, because you're not telling me the truth." Delilah wanted a no-secrets relationship. "Tell me everything." You know? And so she nags him. It came about, verse 16, "She pressed him daily with her words and urged him that his soul was annoyed to death." I love the way New American Standard translates that. The word "annoyed to death" means vexed in spirit. Grieved. She nagged him. She pressured him so that he was annoyed. But he wasn't annoyed enough to leave her. He was annoyed enough to tell her. Instead of fleeing the temptation, he tells her his secret. Notice verse 17. He told her all that was in his heart. A razor has never come upon my head, for I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I will become weak and be like any other man. The word secret is literally all his heart. He told her everything. Hard to believe he would get to that place and do that. But again, I'm convinced that the sin of pride and the lust of the eyes can make a person do irrational things. And Samson certainly does an irrational thing. What's fascinating again in the text is verse 18, Delilah saw. Yes, sir.
I had the impression that he was just tired of listening to her and was committing suicide.
Well, that's an interesting thought. He'd rather be in the relationship and be dead than get out of the relationship and be alive.
Yeah. Well, people get depressed.
Yeah, well, this is true. He'd had enough.
Yeah.
So he told her, that's for sure.
Surely he knew what was going to happen.
He had to know. Well, because he told her. At least it appears, you know, at this point that he really believed that to be true, but maybe he didn't really believe it. Because when the story goes on and she calls for the Philistines, he gets up as if nothing has changed. He doesn't stay down and say, yeah, I'm done. He gets up as if to defend himself, but everything's changed. And so you're really wrestling with what Samson knows, understands, believes, and his commitment to that. He knows the secret of his strength is not the hair. It's in the fact that the Lord had provided that for him through the Nazarite vow. But the hair is the symbol of that vow. And I suspect, and this is just my suspicions, that Samson felt that even if his hair got shaved, God would still take care of him. He'd still be strong. He'd gotten to that point in his spiritual walk where he could presume upon God. Because for 20 years, he'd been invincible in everything he had done. Yes, sir?
So you're saying that his answer here, he thought that he was giving her another fake answer?
No, I think he was giving her the right answer. He knew where his strength came from, but he didn't think it mattered. In the sense that even if I lose my hair, even though that's where the symbol of my Nazarite vow, I'm still going to be victorious.
He's already broken nearly every other element of the
vow.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. And because he hadn't suffered any other consequences, why should he suffer consequences now? The word where it says Delilah saw, again, it's the same word. When Samson saw the woman in Timnah, Samson saw Delilah. Delilah saw. But Delilah sees the truth. Samson saw the outward. Delilah saw the heart of the matter. She knew that Samson had told her the truth. So the first thing she does is tell the Philistines, who obviously needed time to get there. Secondly, the text says, verse 19, she made him sleep on her knees. Now again, I'd like to suggest to you that's a very euphemistic phrase, is that Delilah gave to Samson what he really wanted, which is the intimacy of the relationship of a man with a woman. And I suspect, again, the text doesn't say this, that she had been withholding that element for a number of weeks while she nagged him to death. And he got frustrated physically as well as emotionally, and the only way he knew to get what he wanted was to give in. So he tells her. She gives to him what he really wants, and he goes to sleep. Maybe he drank a lot before that or after that as well, I don't know. For the fourth time, Delilah alerts the Philistines. For the fourth time, when she cries out, the Philistines are upon you, he awoke from his sleep. And notice what the text says. I will go out as at other times and shake myself free. See, I don't think, again, he thought he was going to suffer any consequences. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. That has got to be one of the saddest verses in all of Scripture. He didn't know that God was no longer there. He knew that God had given him the strength. He gave credit to God for the victories that he'd had in the past. You find that in the episodes where he said, "You've given me this victory." But when God actually leaves, Samson doesn't know. He doesn't realize, yada. He doesn't understand. One writer says, it's one thing to be spiritually weak because of sin. It's quite another, even tragic, to not even know it. The Philistines seized him. Verse 21, gouged out his eyes, brought him down to Gaza, bound him with chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. Grinding a handmill was the lowest task of a slave. It was very humiliating, and in that culture, it was often done by the women. The chains, New American Standard says brass, and it's a dual form, so it probably means that both his hands and his feet were chained. So he was secure. And the person who had always operated on the basis of sight could no longer see because his eyes were gouged out. His hair was shaved off. But in the midst of the tragic situation, the author gives a faint ray of hope. Verse 22, however, the hair of his head began to grow again after it was shaved off. There's only one reason for that to be there. God is still at work. Something else is going to happen in the story. Again, it's common to us. We know the story, so we know what's going to happen. But for those who are reading it for the first time, why is that there? Because it's the ray of hope. And why in the world the Philistines didn't keep Samson's head like Lee's head, I have no idea. Why they didn't shave it on a weekly basis to be sure his strength never came back, I have no idea. Maybe they thought, we won. Pride for them did the same thing that it did for Samson. It ultimately ended up in their demise. Let me give you three takeaways, if you will, that I got from this up to this point and Samson's adventure. Number one, Samson's imprisonment is a telling picture, a literal picture of the tragic state of the wages of sin after the length of a prolonged rebellion. His prison was literal. I mean, his prison was a foul-smelling dungeon by night and never-ending toil by day. His eyes were gone. His body was bound. When we prolong our sin and refuse to repent, our prison may not be that literal, but it could easily consist of wasted lives and broken homes. One writer suggested that prolonged, ongoing sinful behavior is like a woodpecker. Each particular attack makes noise, but it doesn't seem to do much damage. But like a woodpecker, if you let it chip away at your life long enough, it'll leave many an ugly hole that never fills. And I just think that's a good picture. Samson was controlled by the lust of the eyes. In his case, he saw a woman that was attracted to him, and what he saw, he wanted, and what he wanted, he got. So let's talk about the eyes just for a moment, because this is where my mind went in what we see. The Hebrew word is ra'ah. It means to look at, inspect, perceive, consider. So it's not a glance. It's something that you actually, you look at it. It's like going to an art museum. You saw the paintings, but you saw this painting. You looked at it. You thought about it. The first time we see this word is in Genesis chapter 1. God saw what he created, and it was what? Good. It was good in character. It was good in its beauty. It was good in its abundance. It was intrinsically good. And it was beautifully good. God saw it, and it was good. Well, being created in God's image, he's given us the ability to see. Matter of fact, Proverbs 20 and verse 12 reminds us that seeing is a gift from God. What a blessing, if we actually stop and think about it, when you see the beauty of creation. When you see the beauty of another person, when you see the beauty of an artist, whether that's a painting or a performance, to be able to see it in all of its beauty is a gift. The problem wasn't with what Samson saw, because seeing is a gift, but what he focused on once he'd seen it. Because what he saw, he lusted after. He desired it for himself, even though he knew it was not approved by God. He knew what the boundaries of the Nazarite vow were because his mother told him. The scripture reminds us of that. Samson ended up living out Jeremiah chapter 17, 9. The heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And again, I've already mentioned when Eve saw the fruit, that it was delightful to the eyes, which would be very true. God created it. It was good. It had to be delightful. She took it and she ate it, and you know the rest of the story. But what God created was good. What happened in the garden is Satan caused Eve to doubt God's goodness. And once you doubt God's goodness, it's basically downhill from there. She sinned. And that's why the psalmist in Psalm 119 and verse 37 prays, "Turn my eyes from looking at vanity, worthless, empty things." The Message paraphrases that, "Divert my eyes from toys and trinkets." I like that. Key principle to avoiding falling to the lust of the eyes is to pray that God helps me look at the right things. Keep my mind from going and that my eyes from seeing the pleasures of sin is more important than the joys of a relationship with you. Because if sin wasn't pleasurable, none of us would do it. Second principle is found in Job chapter 31 and verse 1, where Job said, "I've made a covenant with my eyes." My paraphrase is, "I've signed off in an agreement concerning what I'll look at," says Job. It's choice. We may not always be able to choose what we see, but we can choose to do. But we can choose what we do with what we see. So, if we want to avoid the lust of the eyes, and if you go to the New Testament, you find the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and pride of life as the three major areas of temptation where we fall. To avoid the lust of the eyes, pray that God helps you to see the right things, and make a covenant to look at the right things. Just two interesting thought. That's about the eyes. That's about Samson's wages. Second principle, it's interesting to note to me the people that Samson hung out with when he wasn't alone, which was the vast majority of the time. First, he was attracted to the Philistine woman from Timnah, then the prostitute from Gaza, and then Delilah. Here's the women, the people, if you will, for lack of a better way to put it, that Samson chose to spend his time with. Ultimately, that led to his demise. And it's not because they were women. It's because none of these women had any relationship with God. They had no spiritual influence. There may very well be nothing that shapes our character more than the people we choose to hang out with. Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 15, 33, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." Now, God is not calling us to be isolationists. You know, get into our holy huddle and never see any other non-believers. Matter of fact, some of the believers I know, I don't hang around with them. They don't help me much either. Chuck Swindoll calls them joy suckers. They suck the joy right out of your life. But the people we choose to spend the amount of time, significant amount of time with, ought to draw us into a deeper relationship with Jesus as opposed to pull us away. Company matters. And again, that's why the church is a fellowship. That's why the church is a family. And again, I think, and again, that's my prejudiced opinion, the tremendous value that grace offers, that sense of connectedness to each other, and being a family, and being holding each other accountable, and hearing God's word. But it is about the fellowship. It is about the joy that comes from connecting with good people and spending time with people like that. Samson reminds us that it's important to evaluate with whom we spend time. Third, the biblical account of Samson does not begin with once upon a time and end with happily ever after. There's really only one way, from my perspective, to understand the story of Samson, and that's from a divine point of view. Only God, in his infinite wisdom, would choose to use a man like Samson to accomplish godly tasks. Part of the answer or perspective is to understand how incredibly patient and God is, not only with Samson, but with us. Because if there's one thing that Judges tells us over and over and over, is that God uses flawed people to accomplish his work. And even when we fail, he reaches out to us with grace and compassion. Samson illustrates the vast extent of the amazing grace of God. Not as an excuse for us to sin, because I can sin, I can do whatever I want, because ultimately Samson paid the consequences. But the amazing grace of God gives us security and hope and joy, even in our worst moments, because God uses people like us to accomplish his purposes. But there's the end of the story is soon to be told. So next week.